Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners working in Africa, Australia, Ireland, Switzerland, and England will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Why countries win lawsuits against water providers. What diseases drug companies won't touch, and where privatisation makes you sick. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. Think globally, act locally. How many times have you heard that before? It's the catch cry of activists on stickers and posters across the world. So, in that spirit, Radio New Internationalists, which is normally produced with our program partner at community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, is stepping outside its patch for a few weeks to work with community radio stations like yours. They're bringing to our airwaves local concerns, then we're linking them up with people across the globe to share experiences, knowledge and strategies. 2 weeks ago, we worked with a team at Shmoo FM in Scotland. A big hello to all our friends there in Aberdeen, where housing activists from Scotland and England swapped ideas with progressive thinkers from Cuba, Germany and Russia. This week, I'm delighted to be sitting in Near FM in the Irish city of Dublin with one of Ireland's greatest alternative media champions, Jack Byrne. You've chosen health as the hot issue in your community, Jack. Why?
Currently, the big issue in Ireland around privatisation is health. It's dominating most discussions. The current Minister for Health is very keen to see an expansion of privatised medicine in this country. I think it's wrong. Just as a user and a patient, I've always found the health service and the health service workers exceptionally caring and professional, and they work under extremely difficult conditions. They're under-resourced, which gives rise to the idea and the complaints that public health doesn't work and is dysfunctional, and it's leading to the promotion of this myth that to privatise the whole thing will solve all the problems. And I'm concerned because I think it's an error, and I think we need to debate it and maybe alert people to the dangers of going down this road.
One of the things that struck me coming through customs last night was that whole thing of waiting lists for hip replacements being months, even years long. The Irish guy who greeted me at customs was telling me all about it, and I couldn't help be struck by the fact that that's the same arguments that we hear in Australia against public hospitals and for privatisation. Mm-hmm. So let's get to that down the track. Tell me what the Minister for Health is saying about privatisation here in Ireland, Jack.
Mary Harney is the current Minister for Health in the Irish government and has just been returned to that portfolio. A lot of us were dismayed that she retained the position, but she clearly has an agenda. And the challenge she has put to us is basically, do we want to sort of look to and live in Boston or Berlin, is how she has described it. She is positing the idea that, do we want a European national public health service or do we want a privatised American model? Clearly she sees the latter model as preferable. In response to the growing crisis in Irish health, she took herself off to America again last week to investigate how to speed up the process. A lot of it seems to make sense, seems to be plausible. And for people who are waiting, and you can wait for quite some time, to not to A&E, but A&E is excellent.
A&E being?
Accident and emergency services. So to move on from that level can be slow, and there are long waiting lists, and consequently people can jump the queue by taking out private insurance and jumping to the various clinics, where quite often the consultant will bring you back in and jump the queue again with you into the public hospitals and jump the queue with you because you're a private patient. So the system generally is feeding the notion that public health is dysfunctional and it's collapsing. And the myth now is that privatised medicine in Ireland is the way to go. And the minister clearly is promoting this heavily. She introduced a whole new level of bureaucracy, the health service executive, and spokespersons in there clearly are very keen on this idea which is developing here of co-location. So it's full steam ahead now with handing over public land to private people to develop private hospitals. One of them was a glaring example of, and I think Louise, whom we'll talk to later, O'Reilly, will know something about this. The consortium that got the go-ahead for the private hospital in St. James's Hospital, which is right in the heart of old Dublin, proceeded to build a hotel. And when asked about this, they said that it had been in their tender. They actually had tender to build a hotel in a prime location in the centre of Dublin. It would have cost a fortune to acquire this land. So, and yes, this health service executive had actually approved this contract. But we were given the idea that this process of privatising was to speed up access to beds. Yet this particular consortium moved immediately to build a hotel rather than the hospital.
That's an unbelievable story.
Now, this is how sort of ludicrous and how shameless they are about this whole idea of privatising health.
Louise O'Reilly, you're the National Nursing Official for the Irish Union SIPTU, the Services Industrial Professional Technical Union. Jack's just posited an amazing picture, actually, Louise. What's the position of the union here?
The co-located hospitals that Jack referred to, they're designed by the health service, or they tell us that what they'll bring us is more beds. Now, you have to understand this in context. Our health service and the health service executive and the people at the very, very top tell the unions day after day after day that we don't need more beds. What we actually need is to reform our work practices. Now, any trade unionist will know that reform our work practices is generally management speak for more work for less pay. So there's no bed crisis. There's the people on trolleys are there because of outdated work practices. Then in the same breath, but at the other side of their mouth, they will tell us that the co-located hospitals will bring us the beds we need to end the bed crisis. From my union's perspective, we are committed to and dedicated to pursuing a decent health service that is funded by the government and is available to people when they need it, not based on their ability to pay, but based on their need, their level of acuity. I think that's no more than the people of Ireland deserve. It's an issue that never goes away. I think in any country in the world, the issue of health never goes away. No country has a perfect system. But in this country, with the government that we have, and in particular the Minister for Health that we have, she is intent on pursuing a very right-wing privatising model, which obviously would put her at variance to the trade union movement.
Well, today we're talking about that particular balance between the public and the private and what that balance should be. Can we get a little bit more information from the union perspective on what the Minister for Health in Ireland is saying? We understand from Jack that she's going for a US privatisation model. What's she saying behind closed doors?
Well, I understand that she's pushing this model. She's pushing a business model of health because the party that she comes from, the Progressive Democrats, would be in favour of deregulation so that the market can compete against what she would see as vested interests. Now, vested interests would be people like myself, workers' representatives. Now, anyone who has any sense at all will see when business becomes involved in health, then people stop being treated on the basis of need and start being treated on the basis of how much can they pay. And certainly a health service that is driven by profit is no friend of working people.
Can I just come in there? Because nevertheless, Mary Harney, Louise, has suggested recently, she made a statement about her basic values and commitments to the health service. She made a pledge to patients. She said, "You will be safe. You will get the best quality care for the best possible outcome. You will be seen and treated on the basis of medical need." That seems quite laudable, and it seems like a commitment to make change in the interest of the patient.
I sincerely hope that anybody who heard the Minister for Health saying that will look beyond the spin. Because to be honest with you, the spin that comes out of the Department of Health would take your breath away at times. I'll go through it point by point if you don't mind.
Okay.
One of her pledges, you will be safe. Hospital acquired infections, MRSA.
Yes.
This is the scourge of the Irish healthcare system, and it's one that she would like to sweep under the carpet.
And MRSA is?
It's hospital-acquired infection. There's various other ones. C. difficile is another one. They're basically hospital superbugs. So we will see in our media at the moment, they're pushing a big campaign to healthcare professionals to say, have you washed your hands? This is an insult to every person working in the health service, because any research will tell you that when bed occupancy rates go over 85%, MRSA thrives. That is a fact, because health professionals haven't time to clean when the beds are being turned over so quickly and so much. They don't have time to deal with the issues. Now, whether or not health professionals wash their hands is a very, very minor factor. And I think that to hijack the debate on MRSA and make it all about the fact that healthcare professionals, as adults, grown men and women, don't wash their hands is a nonsense. Bed occupancy rates in this country are regularly over 100%, and we're back to the bed crisis again. And that's what creates the environment where MRSA will spread. In order to cure them, you need a huge amount of facilities that are not available in this country. You need dedicated infection control staff, which we only have in two of our hospitals. You need isolation units for people, because when you contract it, you're highly contagious and it spreads through a hospital like wildfire. So unfortunately, we have them, and we have MRSA in a lot of our hospitals, and indeed much of it goes undetected. I would hazard a guess that if we were to know the true picture, that people would be terrified.
Right.
And the second point
that
you made...
That you'll get safe, you get the best possible quality care and the best possible outcome.
Patient satisfaction surveys that are conducted year on year in the health service show that people are happy with the care they receive.
Absolutely, I can confirm that.
But that's down to the dedication of the frontline staff. That's not because of a stroke of a pen in Merrion Square, certainly not. And I'm pleased to see that the Minister, when she says we'll get the best quality care for the best possible outcome, that she's standing behind the staff that work in the health service.
Nevertheless, I have to remind you, she also went on to say private health care can be used to improve services for all. So the bottom line for the Minister is, if you want this to be safe, better quality care, to be treated on the basic medical need, you need private health care.
Yeah. Co-located private hospitals, only the ones that are planned at the moment, will cost the Irish taxpayer in the region of €700 million over the next 7 years. This is a business model. It won't improve patient outcomes. It can't, because it is the most expensive way of providing beds. So you use the most expensive way of providing beds. You are taking money out of where it is needed. At the end of the day, I can't see how that is going to improve the quality of healthcare.
There's also, I mean, the case of that these hospitals will deal with minor cases. They won't deal with the crises.
But that's what's known as cherry picking. So planned procedures are profitable. If you know in advance that someone is going to need an operation, you can plan for it. But what happens when, touch wood, something goes wrong? That person ends up back in accident and emergency. They need a level of care that it is not profitable. That happens very, very often, and they cherry pick because planned procedures are very, very easy to make a fast buck on. And it comes back to the same argument every time: when business gets involved in health, it is not good for sick people.
It's already evident. That's why I can't understand why people are buying into more of it. That's my sort of puzzlement.
Fear and panic.
Yeah. Now, Chris.
Let's go now and see how privatisation is working or not working in other countries. In the British Medical Journal in November last year, Associate Professors Steffi Woodhandler and David Himmelstein ask, why would anyone choose to emulate the US healthcare system? Costs per capita are about twice the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development average. 47 million people are completely uninsured. Many others with insurance face high out-of-pocket costs that hinder care and bankrupt more than a million people annually. Mortality statistics lag behind those of most other wealthy countries, and even for the insured population, clinical outcomes and patient satisfaction are mediocre. It's a pretty damning report card, that one, with which the president of the Australian Doctors Reform Society, Dr. Tim Woodruff, agrees. He's just dropped into our airwaves. Tim, let's go through each of these areas one by one. First of all, Tim, let's describe how the US system works. All of us who've watched...
It doesn't.
Perhaps I should say how the process operates. For all of us who've watched American movies, and let's face it, all of us have, we see a system of insurance there. Can you describe that to us? And can you also tell us about what happens to the 47 million people who aren't insured?
Well, basically, the system is such that if you want good health care, you really need to have private health insurance. There is a public system. The public system, however, is somewhat restricted to the elderly or to the extremely poor. So we've got over 40 million United States citizens who are uninsured, and a significant percentage also who are underinsured. They just haven't got enough to deal with illnesses as they come along. So it's just a monumental challenge for people who aren't extremely rich to be able to manage healthcare costs. Now, the people who run the private health insurance system, there's various organisations that do it. They've had a long history of business paying the insurance costs of workers so that it's kind of part of the package of employment, especially many of the larger businesses. And that's gradually fading as the expenses becoming too high for businesses to continue to do that.
And when we're talking about an insurance package, how much does it cost the average person to get comprehensive medical insurance for their needs?
I think a cheap one had probably started about $5,000.
Per year?
Yeah, that's a really cheap one.
That's a substantial amount of money, isn't it? The question, I suppose, that strikes you is that if 47 million people in America are uninsured and they get some type of disease or condition that is life-threatening, what happens to them?
Well, they end up at a public hospital and they'll probably get the basic care if they can get through the door and through the overcrowded emergency department. However, then most of these conditions need follow-up and they'll go back into the community and what will they get? Basically nothing again, and they'll bounce back and forth and back and forth until they die.
And so in terms of health outcomes, mortality rates not as good in the private field as the public field. Can you explain that a little bit further for us, Tim?
Basically in the United States, about 15% of private hospitals are for profit. Now there's an awful lot of private hospitals in the United States to run this system. There's an awful lot also of hospitals that aren't run for profit, they're run by religious groups and they aren't necessarily included in the figures. The concerning thing is that the for-profit hospitals are increasing their percentage. It was 12% of private hospitals a few years ago, it's now up to 15%. And if you compare the death rates, the mortality in those hospitals with the public system, which is struggling anyway with lack of resources, if you compare their mortality figures, you find reasonably consistently that the private hospitals are basically more dangerous places to be in. And that's for a variety of reasons. It would include the fact that a lot of them are going to be smaller. But even with the bigger ones, the problem is that, as the others have said earlier, that we have a profit motive, and the profit motive is going to win out in a private for-profit institution. And what is found is that they, for example, have less nursing staff, but they have more administrators. And so we find that the efficiency equation, that is money in versus medical outcomes out, is really distorted because the medical outcomes are worse and it costs more to run them. It's just a crazy situation. And if anybody is looking to practice evidence-based policy of any kind, then they must look at this ridiculous situation in the United States and address the problems that they have in their own country, like Ireland, and just consider just what they're doing, because it is going to be a total disaster. It's already been a mini disaster in Australia. We've had in Australia a situation where we have decided to support the private system to expand. What happens in that situation is that we have in the co-located private hospital a waiting time to get a hip replacement of a few weeks. In the public hospital right next door, you can't find an anaesthetist to do the operation. There's no shortage of anaesthetists. They're right there, but they're next door in the private sector. Or you can't find a surgeon or something like that.
And the interesting thing about that is, as I understand it, the private hospitals in Australia that are favoured by current policies are about 10% costlier than the public ones to run. I'm just wondering, taking your example that you've just raised, Tim, that issue of hip replacements, I get greeted in customs last night with a hip replacement example about how we need to go to privatisation by the customs officials who interview me. I'm wondering what you think about what we're told about that, that the present system is broken, that these problems, which are in Ireland, which are in Australia, which are all over the world, which are actually convincing the public to actually turn against the public system and go for the private system. Can the private system handle them?
Well, the private system won't be able to handle most of them. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this is a very deliberate, conscious ploy to destroy people's faith in the public system. If you underfund the public system, yes, it will fall apart. If you don't address the problems in the public system of organisation and structure, it will fall apart and people will get disenchanted. If you don't look at the drivers of the problems in public hospitals, then people will get disenchanted and be scared into private insurance. And there was a deliberate policy in Australia of scaring people into private insurance. They had an advertising campaign funded by the government of the day 10 years ago, to actually scare people into taking private insurance. And those advertisements were all about, this is where you'll get the good care, and by implication you won't get it in the public sector. So that's a very deliberate ploy by governments that want to privatise to destroy people's faith in the public sector.
The scenario that you've painted, the scenario that Louise O'Reilly here in Ireland has painted, clearly shows that privatisation doesn't work. However, our governments tell us that it's the preferable system, and indeed many people in the public arena believe it. What are private hospitals and private insurance companies doing to convince our policymakers and our people that the private sector is going to deliver better health outcomes for our people?
Well, what I think they do is carefully avoid evidence. And it is really disappointing that the politicians carefully avoid the evidence too. We have this evidence from the United States. It's being ignored. We have evidence in Australia of the huge cost of the private scheme. It's being ignored. And instead, what is quoted is the evidence of throughput. That is, how many hip replacements we did at our private hospitals this year. Isn't that great? Yeah, but I mean, they've chosen the easiest patients to operate on, and they get them through quickly. That's very good, but it's not called efficiency. I mean, any economist will tell you that performance relates to outcomes and cost, looking at the difficulty of the problem that you've got in front of you. So the motivation clearly is generally that they're business people who are trying to run a business. And I suppose the problem with politicians is that so many of them are somewhat removed from the reality because they're all on healthy incomes. They can all afford private health insurance. And they simply don't see that so many of their constituents are really going to suffer in the long term.
Louise O'Reilly, you're representing a wide range of healthcare workers. $5,000 for an insurance policy, what do you reckon? The Irish people up for that?
I was at a public meeting on Monday night about the health service and what we're calling a crisis. And I think a couple of points that were made that really hit home with me. A number of people in the audience, and again, I mean, we're talking about ordinary working people, put their hands up to say that they can't afford private health insurance, but they have it. They're being pushed. And you have to look at what's behind this project. What's behind this project is right-wing political people who are friendly with big business, who will make a fortune out of co-located hospitals. And they get a double whammy. Firstly, when they bring the private sector in, they put a bit of distance between themselves and the health service. Health is always bad news. You go to any country in the world, you talk to any trade union official representing healthcare workers from anywhere in this world and they will tell you health is always bad news. In Ireland, we look to Scandinavia, so they do everything fantastic. Health is bad news. Even in Scandinavia, you bring the private sector in, it means the government can say, meh, it's not us. It's not our problem and it's not our fault.
It's a good point, actually. It's almost as if government is divesting itself of any responsibility for the major things that count in our life. Absolutely. How does it look to you, Tim?
Well, I'll just go back a little bit and make one point, and that is a potential danger for your situation there in Ireland and what happened to us here 10 years ago, and that is that because the cost of private health insurance was so high and the private health insurance coverage was actually dropping over a period of years because the public system was working quite well, the government decided to subsidise it. And so private health insurance in Australia doesn't cost anything like that. People can have private health insurance in Australia for $3,000 and a cheap policy for $1,000 or $1,500. That's about half it for euros. So it's not out of reach in that sense, but it still is enormously challenging for so many families. So that's a concern, and it really doesn't change the basics of the problem, which is that you are then using public money in your subsidy to line the pockets of those who run the private system. And you then still further divide the community because those who can scratch together the money manage to queue jump, whilst the rest, by far the majority, and generally the most needy, who can't earn as much money anyway because they're chronically ill, miss out.
Indeed. I'm wondering what inducements or what arguments are being used by private companies for nurses and doctors to accept this system. Louise O'Reilly, can I ask you from the Irish experience, being a national nursing official yourself?
Well, we would have a number of private hospitals already in existence in this country, and their wage rates keep pace with the wage rates in the public hospitals. They wouldn't necessarily have the staffing issues currently in Ireland. All the unions in the health service are battling with a recruitment embargo, which basically means the HSE, the health service executive, have said, doesn't matter how sick people get, this is your staffing level, that's it. So the public health service is not a great place to work at the moment, and the private health service would be seen as slightly more attractive if you take a short-term view. If you take a longer-term view, however, you don't get your guaranteed job, you don't get your public service pension or any of those things that would go along with a public sector job. The fundamental point that we really can't lose sight of is that in order for the private system to win, the public system has to fail. And it's failing its staff as well as the people who use it. Now, I would say the health service is a great place once you get through the door, and the people who are working in it, you can't fault them. Having said that, morale in the health service at the moment among nurses and other healthcare workers is at an all-time low, and it's not getting any better. They are up against it night, noon and morning.
Mm. Can I just touch on one other thing also here? Interestingly enough, this particular political party, is they've waged for the last decade this idea that we need lower taxation. Individual citizens should pay lower taxes. And of course, clearly that's where the revenue comes from to fund public services. But interestingly enough, in a very recent national opinion poll, people said that they would be prepared to pay higher taxes to retain and improve public services. So clearly, the problem is the politicians are not listening and are pushing this alternative agenda.
We have exactly the same situation in every report of the public's opinion on where money should be spent. They say, let's spend it on getting better health and education, and would forego tax cuts for that. And still the governments, for political reasons essentially, insist on giving them tax cuts.
So can I ask both of you, I'm wondering, what is the balance between public and private here? What would you like to see first of all, Louise O'Reilly?
Well, as I said earlier, for the private system to win, the public system has to fail. And I'd like to see the public system win. I'd like to see the proper rates of investment, because I think that's what people want. I'd like to see a decent publicly funded healthcare system, which is available to everybody when they need it. And if we had that, we would have no need of private healthcare. We would have no need of a business model if people could be treated when they needed it decently by the public healthcare system.
Tim Woodruff, what does it look like from your perspective in Australia?
Well, absolutely. I mean, all of what Louise said applies equally. The thing is that what we need to do is be demanding that the way that policy is set, the decisions that are made, are based on the best available evidence. And there is absolutely no evidence to indicate that you're getting better health outcomes for your dollar if you go private. It just does not add up. So we have to look at the evidence, and if we do that, we're going to end up saying, keep the for-profit operators out of the system because we're going to have falling standards and higher costs. Is there a place for private not-for-profit? Well, who knows? Let's get the evidence and find out.
That was Dr. Tim Woodruff, President of the Australian Doctors Reform Society and Executive Member of the Australian Healthcare Reform Alliance, together with Louise O'Reilly, who's the National Nursing Official of the Irish Union SIPTU, the Services Industrial Professional Technical Union, representing a wide range of healthcare workers. Louise, Tim, it was great that you were part of the program today. I certainly have learnt a lot. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Delighted to be with you.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station Near FM in Dublin, Ireland. And today we're talking with Jack Byrne. Jack's no stranger to Radio New Internationalist. You might remember that we did a terrific program with him last year inspired by Ireland's oil pipeline resistors, the Rossport Five, jailed for refusing Shell and its pipeline workers entry to their farms. Check it out on the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. But let's return now to today's main game, whether privatisation is good for your health. Certainly not in Tanzania. In 2003, a subsidiary of the British company Bywater took over the running of the water and sewage services in the Tanzanian capital Dar es Salaam. 2 years later, the Tanzanian government cancelled the contract. In January this year, an international panel ordered Bywater's subsidiary to pay $8 million to Tanzania after finding that the capital's water and sewage services deteriorated during the company's contract. Tamsin East, who's the Water Campaigns Officer with the World Development Movement, has been following this case. Tamsin, can you paint a picture for us about the ways in which this has meant worse water for the people of Tanzania?
Yeah, I think you'll see that Tanzania is one of the poorest countries in the world, and about 38% of the population do not have access to clean water. So that is the context the privatisation contract happened in Tanzania. And we've talked to many individuals on the ground. We've been told by people in Tanzania that when Bywater came in, their access to water significantly decreased and the prices for their bills came up. And when we're talking about one of the poorest countries in the world, when you see prices for water double, in some cases treble, it's not a sustainable solution. And also, Bywater focused very much on the city of Dar es Salaam, the centre of the city, where water connections were already existing. But actually, the people of Tanzania without water need new connections, and it was never in the remit of this company to provide new connections to people, which again is evidence that water privatisation is not the solution to the global water crisis, and that there's a preconceived wisdom that a private company will come in, will sort out the problem, will invest into the country, will be more efficient, increase connections, and time and again this is shown to be false. In fact, since the contract has expired, the company has been handed over to public hands, and there is now significant improvement to the water services.
Yes, that's an interesting paradox, isn't it, that the public water system, which the private company was sent in to cure, has actually taken over and made the situation in Dar es Salaam better. Tanzania is not an isolated case, is it? In Bolivia, Latin America, and in Mali and Gambia in Africa, water privatisers have failed to deliver clean and affordable water. So why do poor countries sign up?
There are a number of reasons why poor countries will sign up, but the main reason is a lot of these countries are some of the poorest countries in the world, and they're desperate for money to invest in their infrastructure, in their services. And countries are often put in a very difficult position where they're being urged to privatise their basic services, whether that's health, water or education, in return for debt and aid relief. And often that is too tempting to turn down. And this is exactly what we saw in Tanzania. The international financial institutions put conditions that the water supply, among I think 30 other services, had to be privatised in return for debt relief. And the UK government was also complicit in this approach, funding it with £10 million.
You've said that conditionalities were placed on loans. If privatisation is not delivering the goods, I'm wondering why institutions that lend money, institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, are actually placing those types of conditions on the loans that they're actually making at the moment.
As I said earlier, I think there's a preconceived wisdom that private companies do perform better. But it's interesting because the International Monetary Fund commissioned its own research into the efficiency of private companies and came out saying that there was no evidence they were any more efficient than the public sector. And I think the private sector is seen as a silver bullet, that it can come in and it can fix everything and it's a very easy solution. And international institutions are keen to fund that, to support the companies that often exist in their countries where the main vote holders sit. But evidence shows that we need to support public utilities. It's actually a much more difficult process. There needs to be a whole change management process. There needs to be a lot of support given. We're not saying there isn't a problem in developing countries. There is a problem, but the private companies just can't come in and solve it in a snap.
Yes. Bywater, which is the head company, has got the gall now to be countersuing the Tanzanian government for kicking them out of their contract. What's the latest there?
Well, in fact, this is even more worrying, as we were very pleased to see that with the earlier case, which was City Water versus the Tanzanian government, the ruling went in favour of the Tanzanian government, that services were disrupted, did decline over time. And now there's an ongoing case that's been going on for the last 2 years, which is Bywater versus the Tanzanian government. And it's for the tune of $20 to $25 million US dollars is the compensation that Bywater is seeking. And again, for us, it's another outrageous example of how we now have the situation where a company is effectively suing a developing country government when it itself failed to deliver on its water privatisation contract. And no matter where the wrongs and rights are among this case, it's a very complicated case. If the Tanzanian government have to shell out $25 million, it's only the poor people of Tanzania who are going to suffer, and more profits going to go to a multinational.
Indeed. I saw that the British government spent £9.5 million to develop the privatisation push in Tanzania. Some of it went to Adam Smith International to produce a pop song for £273,000, which was singing that privatisation would bring the rain. What else was the money spent on? That seems like a ridiculous thing to be spending money on in terms of a British government funding a privatisation push in Africa.
I mean, for me, this is an absolute classic example of the outrageous use that the UK government sometimes spends our aid money on. I mean, just to clarify, that was nearly £500,000 British pounds spent to produce a pop song to convince people that privatisation was the way forward. And we saw the song, it was in Swahili, we translated it, it was number one for 6 weeks in Tanzania. And when you think that is aid money, that is not about finding solutions to the global water crisis, that's about a public relations campaign, about pushing privatisation, convincing in many ways a sceptical population that this was a solution. Just to give you some lyrics, young plants need rain, businesses need investment. Our old industries are like dry crops, and privatisation brings the rain. When the harvest comes, there is plenty for everyone. That is what a significant proportion of our money was spent on.
I'm laughing here because they say that progressive organisations push propaganda, but I've never heard such a great push for that.
No, I know. We've managed to quiz the International Development Secretary of the UK about this, and he has admitted in public that that was not the department's finest hour. On a more serious note, we are worried about the communications elements of these contracts that come up. Often when there's a water privatisation contract, there will be a scope in that contract for public communications around the issue of privatisation. And we're very concerned, that's just a pseudonym for public relations to promote privatisation. And even after this Tanzanian debacle, 2 years later, the Department for International Development in the UK issued a very similar water privatisation contract in Sierra Leone. And again, worryingly, it had the same communications element factored into the contract. And the World Development Movement lobbied very hard on the government, rallied many of our supporters around the country, and actually managed to get that contract amended and the communications element removed from the contract. And it's these kind of things that we need to watch out for.
Indeed. Tamsin, thanks for dropping in to tell us about this case. Bye for now.
Thank you.
That was Tamsin East, the Water Campaigns Officer with the World Development Movement, talking about the disastrous water privatisation process in Tanzania, Africa. Africa.
Yahari we banana. Yahari we mutama.
That was Zena Bakar, the golden voice of Mozambique, singing Ohawa on the Yellala CD. Here's the lyric she was singing. We love our African continent, but it's full of problems. We are killing ourselves. We are hurting ourselves. We are destroying what belongs to us. Why doesn't this war stop? Why don't these conflicts end? This continent is full of promises, full of fruit and trees, and there is enough water for us all. More about that CD later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and our co-host today is Jack Byrne from community radio station Near FM in Dublin, Ireland. And today, we're taking the temperature of healthcare systems. Speaking of which, how healthy is the community radio sector here in Ireland, Jack?
It's healthy enough, Chris. It's growing. We're 12 years now in existence. There was 20 years spent before that trying to convince successive governments and ministers that it was a beneficial resource for the community.
And so what's the drive for alternative media here in Ireland?
Well, I was one of the ones sort of pushing it and propounding it. And for me, it was very much to have an alternative to mainstream media to cover issues such as globalisation and climate change and issues like that that are either not dealt with at all by media or trivialised. And we felt that people needed to debate these things. And I think in a democracy, Chris, people need a range of alternative views and opinions before they can make any serious democratic decisions. And I think our concern was that most media, mainstream media, particularly commercial media, gave people a very limited view of the world. So for us, I think the challenge was that community media would offer a wider array of informations from a wider sources across the planet. People have voices and opinions and experiences from around the planet to compare their own experiences against. And I think that's beneficial and has to be good for a democracy. I, again, it's only been brought home to me as we were developing this programme on the health service. I mean, again, in Ireland, and I would have been inclined to fall into this trap myself, we tend to think that people sitting on trolleys and not even having trolleys sitting on the floor in hospitals is a purely an Irish phenomenon.
Yes.
And we're being told that everywhere else in the world is happily having privatised health and doing very well. When in fact, as you compare experiences with people from the United States to Australia to other European countries, privatised health is not working very well at all.
And I can't help but conclude from our next story that governments who leave healthcare to the market are making a fatal mistake. When a disease is epidemic, killing tens of thousands of people a year and threatening millions more, you might expect that every effort will be made to develop a medication that will prevent it or cure it, right? Most probably, provided that you're living in a rich world country with cashed up consumers. But if you live in a poor world country, then the disease is likely to be neglected and a cure nowhere in sight. Anne-Marie Shevchik from the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative has just dropped into our airwaves. Let's go through some of the worst of these diseases, starting with Chagas. Its home is Latin America, where an estimated 16 to 18 million people have been infected. 100 million people around the world are now at risk in 21 countries. What are its symptoms, Anne-Marie?
Well, with Chagas disease, it has a couple of different phases. And when you're in the acute phase, which generally manifests itself as fever, malaise, maybe a bit of swelling in your face, and an enlarged liver, you feel like you have the flu. And this is actually the only good time to treat the illness. But unfortunately, the disease actually spontaneously resolves itself within a month. And so many people never go and seek treatment. So at that point, they then enter what's known as an asymptomatic or indeterminate phase that can last up to 10 years or to life. And during this time, the parasite is basically attacking the person's heart and their liver. And they might feel a little less energetic than they typically would, but they don't really notice anything severe. Unfortunately, then the chronic stage of Chagas disease will affect about 1 in 3 people. And by this point, you've gone into congestive heart failure or liver failure, and there's really no opportunity for any treatment outside of transplantation. And because we're dealing with patients who really are poor and living in rural areas, that's not even really an option for this group of people.
So how do people get it?
So they actually get the disease through a relatively benign insect known as the kissing bug. But sadly, the kissing bug contains a protozoa parasite that attacks your liver and your heart.
In simple terms, what medications are available for Chagas now?
There are really only two treatments, and these treatments are only available for that acute infection of the disease, which I was speaking to you about, where people think that they just have the flu. So where you're entering, where the parasite is really invading the heart and the liver over those 10 to 30 years, there's no treatment for you once you actually find out you have the disease. And the two treatments that are available, one is called benznidazole, and it takes 2 months to treat the patients, and it's only effective in 1 out of 2 patients. And you can imagine in a rural treatment center for where a lot of these patients are 3 or 4 hours away from a treatment center, perhaps by boat, by having to go through heavy jungle, this is a very difficult treatment. And there's also no pediatric formulation, which is critical because there are a lot of children who are living in these rural areas in Latin America who are actually picking up the disease. The other treatment is nefertamox, and that also has a very limited use. And it's the same problem also with diagnostics as well, is that there really need to be diagnostics that can tell you you have the disease at an early stage so that effective treatments can actually get to you. So it's a failure for these neglected diseases not only of having effective treatments, but also having effective diagnostics to tell patients and to tell practitioners that patients are suffering from the disease.
And why is that not available at the moment? We haven't got there in terms of research and development?
Well, you know, it's a full failure for some of these neglected diseases. It's a market failure primarily, where drug development has largely been confined to the pharmaceutical industry, the R&D-based pharmaceutical industry, and their focus is market-based. What's happened is drug R&D has been focused much more on diseases and patients that can guarantee significant financial returns for the big investment that is required to actually develop a new treatment. And so while there's been some publicly financed research institutes involved in early stage drug and R&D, it hasn't translated itself all the way across the pipeline. So there's been a lot of research in the last decade that's sort of transformed a lot of our knowledge about these parasites. But unfortunately, the research has never translated through the full drug R&D pipeline. And unfortunately, it's a market failure that's then compounded by public policy failure. Because both globally and within these countries where neglected diseases exist, there just hasn't been the political will or the financial resources to invest in long-term health development. And that's really led to what's known as the 10-90 gap, which is that even though over the past 30 years we've seen a huge transformation of global health, when you think about the treatments that are available in the United States or Europe or Japan for diseases like cancer or HIV/AIDS, that hasn't been transformed to a large number of diseases which have a huge amount of the global burden. And so the 10-90 gap is basically the fact that you see only 10% of the money is spent on the diseases that affect 90% of the world's population. Our primary objective at DNDi is to develop 6 to 8 new treatments for specific neglected diseases like Chagas disease, like sleeping sickness, another very lethal disease.
Yes, well, I suppose where there's a will, there's a way. With this disease and others in the neglected category, the thing that stands out about those working on a cure is the near absence of the pharmaceutical giants. How do they explain their neglect?
Pharmaceuticals are driven primarily by market-based incentives, and they want to make money off of the large amount of money that they do actually have to invest in drug research and development. To find a new compound and progress it all the way through the drug development pipeline, companies estimate that they're investing between $100 million to up to $1 billion.
Wow.
So you can see that if they can't have a guarantee of a return on investment, even at cost, it's a difficult persuasion to necessarily make for a pharmaceutical company. Because the other thing is, it's also very high risk in the sense that 1 in 1 million compounds is actually going to make it to the patient. And so one of the critical things is that there needs to be some government-based incentive to pharmaceuticals, an incentive to actually invest in neglected disease R&D. And what we've seen is that in the last decade, there has been an awareness about this lack of effective treatments, thanks to organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières and their access campaign, to Oxfam, and even within the World Health Organization itself. And there's been this new model, of which DNDi is one of a number of up to about 15 different product development partnerships, and four that are specifically devoted to neglected disease R&D.
I'm thinking as you're talking, I was reading last night about sleeping sickness. It's part of the market forces on this is that drugs are developed, they can be used, but they're actually skewed to consumers who pay money. So, for instance, something that could cure or address sleeping sickness is actually being used and sold for removing facial hair in the United States. There had to be a bit of encouragement for that particular pharmaceutical company to come across the line and provide that drug in a form it could be used in Africa for sleeping sickness, didn't it?
That is very true, and actually that is really a case of Doctors Without Borders and this access campaign of Médecins Sans Frontières pushing Sanofi Aventis to basically develop a form of the drug that could actually be used to treat a fatal disease, when in fact they had developed a treatment that was basically catering to vain rich women of the Western world, shall we say, while poor Africans were dying.
Yes, it's an extraordinary comparison, really. I mean, your organisation is about this, isn't it? It's about arranging for research and development to take place and actually arranging for countries who are affected to stand up to the plate, their institutes to stand up to the plate and actually partake in this research and development initiative.
That's very true. We were actually started out of the Access Campaign of Doctors Without Borders. And when we chose our founding partners, one of the most critical things was that to have a sustainable commitment and a sustainable response over 20 or 30 years, we had to involve research institutes in the countries where these diseases are affecting all of these poor patients. And so we are very much a needs-driven organization, using our founding partners like Doctors Without Borders and these research institutes in Kenya, in Malaysia, in India, and Brazil, that we really make sure we know what the needs are on the ground.
One of the things I like about this initiative is that you're actually kind of combining all the research and development tools you need by actually relying on countries' specialities. How is that going?
Well, we've had some good success so far. I mean, DNDi was founded in 2003, and last year, with Sanofi Aventis, we actually made our first product available, which is a fixed-dose antimalarial drug. And it's the first time that there is a highly effective pediatric strength medication available for children in Africa. And we've now had over 1 million treatments bought and getting distributed to those patients most in need. And that's actually an example, though, where this project was started by a large number of public partners across the globe. We had partners in Brazil, in Thailand. We had clinical research partners conducting the clinical trial in Burkina Faso. And we had a small biotech that was based out of the University of Bordeaux that actually created the innovation of putting these two different drugs together in one tablet to make it so much easier for patients to actually receive the treatment. And it was only then, when we have done all of that, that we were able to persuade Sanofi Aventis to join us as the industrial partner.
So can I ask here, are Big Pharma, the big pharmaceutical companies, supportive of Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, or do you find that they sometimes work against you?
We haven't found that they work against us, and they are a critical partner for us, actually, in the sort of industrial scale-up as we enter the clinical stages where we're testing drugs in patients. It's critical that we utilize the pharmaceutical industry for their know-how. But one place where we found some difficulty, but also a lot of willingness to work with us, is to open up their millions and millions of compounds in their pharmaceutical libraries to allow us to study those compounds specifically for neglected diseases. However, there is still a big issue of intellectual property, which is not just with pharmaceuticals, and is actually even more surprising. The bigger difficulty often is with universities, who are highly protective of the researchers and the research that's being conducted by their researchers.
Mm. Well, the Drugs for Neglected Disease Initiative is doing some fantastic work, Anne-Marie. So thank you very much for coming onto our airwaves today to describing it and telling us more about it. That was Anne-Marie Shevchik from the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. I'm wondering, Anne-Marie, if people would like to read more about what you're doing, where would they go?
We would love for them to visit our website at www.dndi.org. And there they can also choose to subscribe to our electronic and print newsletters.
Fantastic, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Anne-Marie Shevchik from the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. A pretty impressive project, hey, Jack?
Absolutely. Very impressive, yes. And getting no publicity for it,
yes,
or acknowledgement, or, you know, it's amazing.
And from what I can see, your volunteers here at Near FM are doing amazing work too. Many thanks, Jack Byrne, for welcoming Radio New Internationalist to Dublin and for all the energy that you and your station have put into today's program. Let's do it again soon.
Okay, you're very welcome, Chris, and it was a great pleasure having you here. Thanks, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jack. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Yellala, or in English, This Is It, sung by the band Ifuro with lead vocalist Zena Bakar. Once a fisherwoman, she's now known as the Golden Voice of Mozambique. And after years of silence, she's back to sing new songs full of melancholy mixed with powerful rhythms with her reformed band. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. That's www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders. If you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. Thanks to Gay Graham, who's been fantastic behind the panel today. Terrific job, Gay. Thank you very much. And everyone at Near FM in Dublin who've been involved in today's production. And thanks, too, to this program's associate producer, Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.